From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. There's a really popular interactive simulation that was created by an educational nonprofit back in 2006, and which has changed very little since then. It's intended to help students learn about the forces that drive ecologies. The simulation is a grid of up to 2,500 squares with three elements: grass, rabbits, and wolves. The rabbits eat the grass, so if there are too many rabbits, the grass dies away, and then the rabbits die away. But if there are a few more wolves, then they eat some of the rabbits, and then the grass returns. But if too many wolves are introduced and the rabbits disappear, then the wolves will start to die, and so on and so on and so forth. And this is a good but pretty simple way of visualizing the long-held assumption that antagonism is the main force that drives ecological balances. Under this assumption, it's negative interactions between species, particularly competition and predation, that determines the structure of communities. And that's true in part. But the biologist Jen Rudgers is working to upend this way of thinking about nature, because in her view, this assumption ignores the positive interactions between organisms and systems that are much more complex than we can even imagine. We are a mutualistic species. We live in a mutually beneficial relationship with the microbes in our guts. And in fact, we wouldn't survive very long without all of those trillions of little tiny creatures living inside of us. And they would die outside of us. It's only been just recently that we've come to understand that this mutualism is so vital to human health. And we're not unique. Mutualistic species are everywhere, and Rudgers says that our understanding of the world around us really has to be informed by that, especially as the world is stressed by climate change. Rudgers is a professor of biology at the University of New Mexico, where her work is aimed at deciphering the complex beneficial interactions among species and ecologies like the drylands of North America. Jen Rudgers, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Jen, you grew up in Akron, Ohio, most famously perhaps the center of rubber production in the United States.
That's right. Both of my grandfathers worked in rubber companies.
So that's a pretty urban, pretty industrial town. Talk to me about how you became so enamored with the natural world.
There are a lot of local parks, and the Cauga Valley National Park is just north of Akron. And I spent a lot of my childhood with my parents hiking around and being outdoors.
What did you like about that experience? Like, what was going on in that park that really set your brain afire?
I've always been sort of a plant person. I would go around my neighborhood when I was little and surreptitiously steal flowers from people's yards and make bouquets for my mom. And so I think I was mostly paying attention to plants, certainly more so than animals. I liked the quiet. I'm definitely an introvert, so just the environment of sort of being away from the bustle was really nice for me. I spent a lot of my weekends hiking or, you know, having breakfast out at a park.
Did you always think, when you were a kid, did you think, okay, that's what I want to pursue in my life? That's what I want to do with myself? Or you just knew you liked it?
Well, so my dad was a lawyer, and I always felt like I would have some kind of environmental career. But for a long time, I thought it would be environmental law.
The generational thing that happened here is really interesting. Two grandfathers who worked in rubber, a father who was in lawyer, and then you're in biology.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did that happen? Because you did pursue environmental science as an undergrad at Denison, right?
That's right. And I think there are two things that turned the corner for me. One was working for a summer in my dad's law office, where I was inside all day, mostly in the copy room, like making copies, and then I would get handed like briefs to run over to the courthouse, like the very last minute to get filed. That was sort of my job for the summer. It was very boring. Being inside all day and working from an office was really not appealing. And then in my third year of undergrad, I did a study abroad where we lived in cabins in the rainforest in Australia. And we did a lot of field-based learning and field-based research. And I was like, this is what I want to do.
Which is not what like biologists do 24/7, right? Like living in the rainforest.
But you can carve out a surprisingly large amount of field time if you make the time for it.
And you've done that. So which allows you to be out and doing that thing, connecting what you do with yourself, with this love for the natural world that you have.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of my insights and sort of discoveries are prompted by things that I've observed when I've been out in the field. It's not just all coming from theory or reading other people's work.
Okay, this is really interesting to me because you kind of like fall in love with this idea in like literally in the middle of a rainforest. And now you work in one of the most arid places in the world, which is that's a big 180. I mean, it's still the natural world. It's beautiful here. It's absolutely, it's gorgeous. But
yeah, I don't know that I've ever had an affinity to one particular ecosystem. I did do my PhD in the Sonoran Desert, and that was where I really fell in love with the beauty and austerity of deserts and, you know, sort of all of the hidden interactions that you don't see until you look really closely because it looks dry.
Yeah, you were studying under Sharon Strauss. She's like a giant in the field of plant interactions with herbivores and pollinators and all the complex interactions between. And so that's what you started really getting into, was like the complexity of the interaction.
Exactly. Yeah, it was the complexity that drove a lot of my interest and passion in the science of it.
And this is where you became really enamored with the idea of mutualism.
That's right. And when I was starting my research career, if you opened any standard ecology textbook and you went to the section on communities and how we think communities are structured and how they work, and you look through the list of like topics, there would be something like how competition structures communities, how predation structures communities. Sometimes, you know, if it was sort of a more recent textbook, how parasitism structures communities. But there was nothing in there about beneficial interactions or mutualism. And when I was an undergraduate, I learned that Ali, who's famous in ecology for the Ali effect, he was a Quaker working during World War II and a pacifist. And he was looking for all the beneficial interactions. And so I learned that he had this very different perspective on ecology sort of being driven by mutualisms and beneficial interactions among species that had been sort of often left out of how we standard like explain ecology or teach ecology. And so that was in the back of my mind, like why isn't mutualism in
here? Did you read that, did you just go yeah, like did you feel like something was missing, and then you like, have you had that experience where you like feel like something is missing and then you find some scholar who's thought about that thing often like decades and decades earlier?
It's like, oh, you know, I'm not the only one. Like,
I'm not crazy.
Yeah, I'm not crazy. Someone else has my back. And yeah, I think that was inspiring to think like this thought has been around, but we haven't really, now that we've entered like the more modern era of ecology where we're doing experiments. Okay, so if competition is important, let's take competition out of the system and see how much it changes. But no one had done that for mutualism yet. So that was a big part of my efforts in my early research career.
Which is a really basic scientific thing to do, right? Like you look at all of the variables and you draw one out to see how the other variables interact without the presence of that. But you think that this idea, the competition predation idea really proliferated because that's often what we could see with our naked eye for plants and animals that were most obvious to us, like big predators, big prey. We were missing something really, really small.
I think that's a big part of it, that there's a lot of beneficial interactions that are symbiotic, microbial, you know, one organism living inside another and you don't see it. But I think the other part of it is more like philosophical, right? Because even in the example that you brought up of the simulation with the wolf and the rabbits in the grass, there's an indirect mutualism where the wolf is benefiting the grass, but we don't talk about that. Right? We just talk about the antagonism part of it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, do you think, speaking philosophically here, do you think that that has something to do with just the way that particularly in the last couple of centuries in this globe, we've tended to look at all things as competitive? Like economic theory is based on competition also, and social theory is often based on competition also.
Yeah, and Darwinian evolution is based on survival of the fittest, which immediately puts your attention to what are the threats.
It's not the survival of the most cooperative. Should it be? I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, right? Of course, it's not survival of the fittest. It's not the survival of the most cooperative, but it's not that extreme where you're just like, whoever is biggest and strongest is going to make it.
Right. But what if what makes you bigger and stronger is a whole suite of microbes that are benefiting you?
You couldn't be that way otherwise.
Yeah. So I do teach it that way. I get like, I try to use examples that include mutualism or positive interactions whenever I can, so that that's not so left out.
What's your favorite example? Like, you're teaching an undergraduate class, you're introducing people to mutualism. What's your favorite example of mutualistic beneficial relationships?
You know, one of the oldest ones for plants is mycorrhizal fungi, which are thought to have evolved, you know, at the time that plants colonized land and sort of facilitated that movement onto land.
What did the fungi do that allowed the plants to make that move?
They form a whole network of hyphae below the soil that forage for nutrients for the plant and also help with water acquisition.
And but not for that, the plants would have stayed in the oceans and no plants on land, no us on land.
That's the theory, yeah. So that would be a favorite. Among examples that I've worked on directly, for a long time I worked on these fungi that are co-evolved with grasses. There are many species of them, but they grow in the leaves of grasses and they make all kinds of toxic compounds that help protect the grass against animals that are trying to eat it, both insects and mammals. They were first discovered in the 70s because a grass called tall fescue became more and more widely cultivated in the U.S. as forage for cattle, and the cows were getting really sick and no one knew why. And finally, some plant pathologists decided to like look inside the grass and see if there was anything toxic in there. And there's this fungus that's systemic. It's like in all the leaves, and it even grows into the developing flowers and gets into the seeds. So when the plant makes seeds, they're already pre-inoculated with this fungus. So it looks like a part of the genome of the grass, right? Because it's transmitted maternally every generation. And so they identified this fungus. It's related to pathogenic fungi that make all kinds of nasty compounds like lysergic acid derivatives, so LSD derivatives, and were making cows really sick. And then there was a whole industry to develop beneficial ones that could be used to make the grass grow better. And so I worked on that tall fescue system as one of the first examples where we could very easily get rid of the mutualism for the whole community and then look at how the community development changes. And it was dramatic. So we planted out these big plots with tall fescue grass.
And pulled out the fungi.
Yeah, well, we planted seeds that had it or didn't have it. And so everything else was the same except for the presence of this fungus. And because it's so closely evolved with the grass, it can't reproduce on its own. So it can't spread from
So that's what the fungi gets out of the relationship.
Yeah, it gets transmission to the seeds and, you know, carbon from the plant. Exactly. Anyway, so we planted these plots with and without the mutualism present. And then we looked at how the community developed under those conditions. And it was so dramatic. So with the fungus, the tall fescue grass was really dominant. Very few other plant species came in, stayed a grassland. Without the fungus, the grass is not very dominant. Bunch of other plant species, plant diversity, biodiversity was much higher. Insect diversity was higher. And trees came in within 4 or 5 years. And, these grasslands started turning into forests. And so, like, the whole development of the community, the trajectory of the community was completely different depending on whether the mutualism was there or not. And it's something you can't even see. Like, you look at the grass, you would never know.
The difference between in an area emerging as a forest or an area emerging as a grassland is this little fungi. Wow. We have this emerging view of these forces that drive ecologies as far more complex than most people had imagined just a few decades ago. This is increasingly well integrated. It is very well integrated in the way that we teach
biology now. I want to take this a step further. So what does this mean now, like when we think about these ecologies and we think about the ways that they are stressed by forces like climate change? Because that upends everything, right? Like now we're not taking something away, we're adding something, adding a stressor. But the whole calculus of it changes.
Well, I guess my focus in that area has really been on, can we find the beneficial partners that provide resilience to climate change, that either allow plants or other organisms to resist change or help them recover quickly after some perturbation? Say there's, you know, a year of extreme drought that these partners, often hidden because they're microbial, can confer some resilience. And how do we understand that and potentially harness it as a way to improve resilience to climate change as we move forward in the future?
And if we don't know what these mutualistic relationships are, then we don't know how to restore that.
That's right. So I have had a big project on these fungi that are very common in plant roots. They are not mycorrhizal fungi, which most people know about mycorrhizal fungi. They're called Ascomycota. They're in a different phylum than the mycorrhizal fungi. They're common. They're often darkly pigmented, like melanized. So they've also been called dark septate endophytes. But we don't know a whole lot about what they do ecologically. And so we've been targeting them as potential climate change resilience mechanisms. And in one experiment, we took a really common native grass and we grew it in the greenhouse where we could control conditions. And then we inoculated in different individual species to try to figure out, okay, what does the Darksidia species do? What does the Curvularia species do? And we found some of these species basically had no effect on the plant if it was cool and wet. But if we heated it up or dried it out or both, we saw plants that were 200% bigger than plants that didn't have any fungal partner added at all.
So if the fungal partner was there, it was a more resistive system against what is a very common climate change stress, which is aridity.
We're excited to keep going with this. And one of the next phases is to try to understand how these fungi interact with bacteria in the soil and how they interact with each other. Because a lot of the work that we've done so far has been very reductionist. Okay, what does species A do? What does species B do? But plants are growing with hundreds of species. An individual plant is growing with hundreds of species of microbes in a natural environment. And so it's much more complex than our reductionistic experiments in the greenhouse.
One of the places that you're trying to understand these shifts is the Sevierra National Wildlife Refuge, which is right in the middle of New Mexico. It's just a little south of Albuquerque, where we are right now. I think a lot of people might look at this area and go, okay, well, it's barren. It's like this northern tip of the Chihuahuan Desert. It's like dry and it's brown. Why would we care about what happens to places like that under climate change? Like, if we could study these mutualistic benefits anywhere, why these really dry, arid places?
I think there are two key reasons. The first is that dry lands like the Sevierra cover currently about 40 to 45% of land area globally. And as climate is changing, that land area is increasing. So dry lands are going to be a bigger part of our global land area in the future. The second reason is that the kinds of climate changes that we're experiencing here in New Mexico and in other dry lands are on the more extreme end of the spectrum, right? So New Mexico is considered the number one most water-stressed state in the U.S. So by studying these systems that are already facing pretty harsh climate changes, we've got like canaries in the coal mine for making predictions about how other places will change in the future. So we're kind of like on the leading edge of understanding the extremities of the change.
Did you recognize that when you first came out here, or is that something that dawned on you after being in New Mexico for a while?
So I moved out here because I was on the faculty at a university in Houston and raising a little baby in the city, which is not my happy place. And so I was looking for a new faculty position that would get me closer to field sites. My closest field sites in Houston were like 2.5 to 3 hours away. So it's not why I moved here, for sure. Did I recognize sort of the value?
New Mexico being the canary kind of value.
No, I would say that sort of came into my view over the first few years of being here as I learned more about the ecology and the history and the challenges, the climate challenges facing this region.
So all of this brings us to this idea of resilience, this idea that we can prepare for and we can recover from and we can adapt to the impacts of climate change. Because the better we understand the complexities that sustain ecologies like the ones that you study, which, as you say, are likely to become a greater part of our world in the future, as we understand that better, the better we can understand either how to protect those ecologies under added stress or how to adapt and survive when those stresses and the resultant effects happen. That's a big part of your work.
Yes, it is. That's sort of the long-term goal, is to find the resilient solutions that we can use moving forward by uncovering and discovering the underlying complexities of the biology to help us make informed decisions for management, for restoration, for climate resilience in ecosystems and also in human communities.
So as you mentioned, New Mexico is one of the driest states in the nation. By some estimates, it's the most water-stressed state in the nation. But it thrives, right? Like, it's a place of art and culture and industry, renewable energy. The urban core of the state is growing pretty quickly. And that doesn't mean everything's perfect in New Mexico or that there isn't any reason for concern about the future in the state. But there's this old thing that Liza Minnelli once sang, more famously that Frank Sinatra sang about New York.
And if I can make it there, I'm gonna make it anywhere. It's up to
a half century
you.
After that song was written, maybe those words apply even better to New Mexico than to New York.
Yeah, certainly going back to the canary in the coal mine analogy, right? Like, if we can understand how resilience happens currently under the challenges here, I think we have potential to apply those principles to places where things aren't so challenging.
That's Jen Rudgers. She's a professor of biology at the University of New Mexico, where her work is aimed at deciphering the complex, beneficial interactions among species and ecologies, like the drylands of North America. Jen Rudgers, thank you.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, and yes, friends, from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.